From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Forbidden Truth. Today we'll look at an explosive new book published in France that's revealed extraordinary details about Bush, oil, and Washington's secret negotiations with the Taliban. Also, the Angolan government has displayed the dead body of CIA-sponsored Reagan-backed rebel Jonas Savimbi. He received millions of dollars from Washington in covert aid. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Pakistan, escorted by dozens of heavily armed policemen. Three men believed to have participated in the abduction and murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl appeared in court today, were ordered jailed for two more weeks while prosecutors developed their case. The accused had been expected to face murder and kidnapping charges, but in a closed-door hearing, the judge delayed the charges to give police a chance to recover Pearl's body. As they arrived at a courthouse in Karachi in armored personnel carriers, the faces of each of the suspects were covered in white cloth. Over the weekend, more harrowing details emerged as to how exactly Daniel Pearl was killed. Sources close to the investigation say a videotape of his killing shows his throat being slit. Officials in Pakistan also say he was decapitated. His wife, Maryam Pearl, a journalist of French descent, called her husband's murder barbaric but made a plea for an end to vengeance in a statement she issued this weekend. An Olympics ended in discord last night following the biggest drug scandal the Games have faced since 1988. 20 people are in jail after a night of disturbances. The U.S. government has spent $320 million on security due to a great national fear of terrorism, they said. But the first time the 15,000 law enforcement officers were finally needed was to control Olympics fans unhappy they could get no beer. The drinkers were dispersed by rubber bullets from the police, and at one stage, the hotel used by the International Olympic Committee as its headquarters was cordoned off. There, Johan Mulig, the Spanish winner of three Olympic gold medals, was facing an Olympic Committee disciplinary panel after testing positive for a banned blood-boosting drug. 10 U.S.-supplied Black Hawk helicopters dropped 200 heavily armed elite Colombian paratroopers into the capital of a former rebel stronghold this weekend as the government poured in ground troops to recapture the zone. One day after Colombian President Andres Pastrana launched a bombing campaign against the haven ceded to FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, in 1998 as a peace gesture, soldiers met little resistance from the FARC. The president abruptly declared the end to the ceasefire after FARC hijacked a civilian airliner to kidnap a senator on board last week. Pastrana flew into the former haven under heavy security today, told about 1,000 people gathered in the town square that the rebels had ruined peace talks and would now be treated as terrorists. Three civilians, including a child, were killed in bombing raids of rebel drug laboratories and airstrips. The United Nations has asked for access to the zone to monitor the effect on the civilian population, but the Colombian government denied the request. We turn now to Martin Eder. He's a professor of sociology at MiraCosta College in Southern California, speaking to us. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you and good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us the latest in this demilitarized zone that the Colombian military has now moved into?
One of the things that went unreported was that when President Pastrana flew into the provincial capital of San Vicente, which the rebels had withdrawn from a month earlier, it was not a conquest of new territory, but in fact, the rebels had withdrawn from there to prevent civilian casualties. President Pastrana told the residents assembled about all the good things that the government had done for them previously and, in fact, was booed by them. There is a generalized fear and actually a large exodus of people from the area because of the human rights abuses. Already the worst in the hemisphere are probably going to get significantly worse as the military and the paramilitaries mount this full-scale offensive on the FARC-controlled area.
Can you talk about the U.S. role, what U.S. aid is going to?
Right now, the U.S. aid is restricted by Congress to be used only for counter-narcotics money. Ostensibly, it has been used in many ways to continue the efforts against the insurgency. What U.S. solidarity organizations are calling for is for all activists to contact Congress members and urge restraint, urge an end to planned Colombia monies, and particularly not allow Bush's new war on terrorism to pump new money into the conflict there, which would make things significantly worse, and to allow, really, what we have seen in Afghanistan to come to our own hemisphere.
Can you explain further the so-called war on terrorism that Bush is waging, how it links Colombia and Afghanistan?
Well, the president and the right wing have been very much emboldened since 9/11 by all of the talk of counterterrorism and found a way in which to end the peace process, knowing that more U.S. aid is going to flow into the country, that there will be more backing for a full-scale assault on the FARC, labeling the FARC as terrorists, as drug traffickers, and in this way really have emboldened their position, strengthened their position for a full-scale military resolution of the conflict. Though all parties in Colombia recognize that the FARC is not going to be dislodged militarily, nor is the government at this point going to be weakened military. Both sides are stronger militarily, and it really is the civilian population that is going to suffer the worst as a result.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Martin Eder, for joining us. What are people calling for in this demilitarized area at this point?
For international monitors to be able to come in and watch, the fear is that the paramilitaries usually move in right after the Colombian government troops pull out of an area or move into an area. These are folks who are as bloodthirsty as anything we have seen in this hemisphere, are backed and are part of their military by day, paramilitary by night, backed by members of the Colombian Armed Forces. Very dangerous to have these folks on the loose.
Martin Eder, thanks for joining us. Professor of Sociology at MiraCosta College in Southern California has just returned from the demilitarized zone in Colombia. You are listening to Democracy Now! Before we end our news headlines, in our last segment, we are going to be talking about the death of Jonas Savimbi. But for listeners who may have to leave, I wanted to touch on it right now. The Angolan government has displayed the dead body of the CIA-sponsored rebel leader. Government officials say he was killed in a commando raid in the far eastern region of the country on Friday. Savimbi was head of the Washington-backed UNITA movement, touted as a key ally against communism by the United States, received as a head of state by President Reagan at the White House in 1986. We're joined right now by Alambe Brath, who will also join us at the end of the program, chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition in New York and a Pacifica WBAI radio producer. Alambe, the significance of Jonas Savimbi's death.
Well, I'm not a person to celebrate anybody's death, you know, but I will tell you this, that few Africans throughout the whole world will mourn his loss because he aligned himself with the most reactionary and backward, even racist forces to try to achieve a goal that was elusive to him for so many years, and that is to be the president of Angola, one of the most wealthy states in Africa, but impoverished by imperialism and colonialism.
The major forces that supported him through these more than 30 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, from the Ford administration, or really built it up into when the Reagan administration, not so much with Jimmy Carter, but all through the George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and throughout until the time of Clinton, actually was some of the changes that the Clinton was trying to deal with in Africa, trying to tilt things favorable to his people in from Hope, Arkansas, the American Mineral Fields Group, that with the diamonds, you know, that actually put Savimbi on a slippery slope because the United States had no more need for him. The Cold War was over. And like Mobutu, it comes a time when the United States, if they use you or anybody else who leads a coup, when it's time for you to go, they will actually move on you.
And the apartheid regime of South Africa also supported him.
More than anybody else, because, and that was one of the things that many African leaders and many people throughout the world who hated the apartheid regime felt that it was very, it was something that you could not allow. You could not justify that. even though he postured as a Maoist and a revolutionary, the idea that he would be seen in the company of South Africa and even to fight to try to gain his objective on the side of South Africa when they invaded in 1975 was something that I felt that put the onus on, you know, him trying to be accepted as something which could never be.
Finally, can UNITA continue without Jonas Savimbi?
They swear
they will.
I doubt very seriously. I think that Jonas Savimbi has been a major bone of contention now, even among his own people, because they felt that it was a peace that needs to come to Angola so that the resource of Angola can be directed toward lifting the people, lives up to a higher scale. It's embarrassing that the majority of people in Angola are suffering so. We need to be one of the richest countries in Africa.
We'll continue this conversation later. Alambe Bratha, he is chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition in New York.
To me. Oh, whoa. I despise, 'cause it means destruction of this life. War means tears to thousands of mothers' eyes when their sons go off to fight and lose their lives. I said, war! Good God, y'all.
What is it good for?
Absolutely. Now get sad again.
War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At Democracy Now!, we often have called the Bush administration the oiligarchy. Vice President Dick Cheney, of course, was head of the largest oil services company in the world, Halliburton. For nearly a decade, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice worked with Chevron. She even has an oil tanker named after her in Nigeria called the Condoleezza Rice. While Secretary of Commerce and Energy Donald Evans and Spencer Abraham worked for another oil giant. Many of the U.S. officials now working on the administration's Afghanistan policy also have extensive backgrounds in the world of multinational oil giants. An explosive new book published originally in France is revealing some extraordinary details of the extent to which U.S. oil corporations influenced the Bush administration's policies toward the Taliban regime prior to September 11th. The book is called Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. It paints a detailed picture of the Bush administration's secret negotiations with the Taliban government in the months and weeks before the attacks on the World Trade Center. It charges that under the influence of U.S. oil companies, the Bush administration blocked U.S. Secret Service investigations on terrorism. It tells the story how the administration conducted secret negotiations with the Taliban to hand over Osama bin Laden in exchange for political recognition and economic aid. The book says Washington's main aim in Afghanistan prior to September 11th was consolidating the Taliban regime in order to obtain access to the oil and gas reserves in Central Asia. The authors claim that before the September 11th attacks, Christina Rocha, the head of Asian Affairs in the U.S. State Department, met the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zayef, in Islamabad on August 2nd. Rocha is a veteran of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. She was previously in charge of contacts with Islamist guerrilla groups at the CIA, where she oversaw the delivery of Stinger missiles to Afghan mujahideen fighting the Soviet occupation forces in the 1980s. The book also reveals the Taliban actually hired an American PR expert for an image-making campaign in the U.S. What's amazing is that the PR officer was a woman named Layla Helms, niece of former CIA director Richard Helms. Helms is described as the Mata Hari of U.S. Taliban negotiations. The authors claim she brought Syed Rahmatullah Hashimi, an advisor to Mullah Omar, to Washington for 5 days in March of 2001. After the Taliban had destroyed the ancient Buddhas of Bamiyan. Hashimi met the Directorate of Central Intelligence at the CIA and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department. The book also says that the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, resigned in July in protest of the Bush administration's obstruction of an investigation into alleged Taliban terrorist activities. O'Neill then became head of security at the World Trade Center. He died in the September 11th attacks. I spoke recently with the authors of the book, Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, Guillaume Dasqui, who is an investigative journalist and publisher of Intelligence Online, and Jean-Charles Broussard, who previously worked for the French Secret Services. I began by asking Broussard what former FBI Deputy Director John O'Neill told him during their meetings.
Yes, in fact, since a couple of years now, you have two divergent strategies on the way to fight terrorism, and that's what the feeling of John O'Neill. The first way is diplomatic policy, which aim was to negotiate with states supporting, hosting, or financing terrorists, eventually to ease or make them stop their support, while preserving Western diplomatic and economic interests, especially oil. On the second hand, you have the security or law enforcement policy, which needed to clearly and fastly establish the role and responsibilities of terrorist networks to prevent or stop further actions. And those two strategies became opposing strategies when it was obvious that you couldn't at the same time try to pursue a state by negotiation and to point out its role or influence in terms of financial or logistical support, and that's what was doing the FBI at that time. And what says John O'Neill is that on Al-Qaeda investigations, diplomacy prevailed over law enforcement interests. And why that happened? Because of oil interests, especially in Saudi Arabia, that led us to close our eyes on the support part of the regime was giving to those radical movements such as Al-Qaeda.
Now, this man, the former FBI agent, O'Neill, how did you learn about him, and how did you learn about the fact that he had quit in frustration over having his investigations blocked because of the U.S. administration's actual support for the Taliban?
Yes, well, I met John O'Neill first in Paris in June of 2001. We were exchanging views on Al-Qaeda financial network. I met him again in July in New York, and that's when he spoke to me about that influence, the fact that the administration was trying to deter or slow his investigation or eventually to block his investigations in Yemen, for instance, on the USS Cole. And so we were exchanging, you know, views about financial network of Al-Qaeda by that time.
Also, the whole issue of the FBI wanting to talk to suspects accused of bombing the U.S. military installation in Dahran in June of 1996. This was in Saudi Arabia, in which 19 U.S. servicemen were killed.
Yes, true. Basically, you have two type of obstacles. Internal obstacles, again, that was the prevalence of diplomacy over security interests, and external obstacles. That's what happened in Saudi Arabia when, for instance, the administration there decided to kill those guys before the FBI could eventually, speak with them.
So the way they dealt with it was simply to execute the suspects rather than let the FBI talk to them.
That's right. That's right.
I'd like to bring your co-author into the conversation, Guillaume Dasqui, again, an investigative journalist, publisher of Intelligence Online. Can you talk a little about Layla Helms, her relation to Richard Helms, a former director of the CIA, and to the Taliban?
Yes, good morning. Layla Helms in his famous story had just the role of a technician. She is a lobbyist working for the Taliban, and her job is to improve their image in the U.S., of course, before the 9/11. For example, she did a documentary with NBC on Afghani women in 1999, which was an element of propaganda showing that the women's lives in Afghanistan were not horrible, and one needed to weigh the pros and cons. But if she was able to talk and behave like that and be an efficient lobbyist, it is because she organized a lot of meetings between Taliban leaders and members of the U.S. administration.
One more time. She did a documentary for NBC in which she showed
right.
how lucky
yes.
Taliban women were?
Yes, that's right. And there's a lot of evidence on that. And so she went in Afghanistan where with NBC TV team and to produce this documentary. And after his documentary is too much propaganda issues, so of course the network refused and never show the documentary, but the documentary still exists.
Now, can you talk about her trip with Saeed Rahmatullah Hashimi, the advisor to Mullah Omar, when she brought him to Washington for 5 days last March, in March of 2001?
Yeah, this is very interesting because it was a few weeks after the new administration set up in White House, and it was just 1 month after, in February, the foreign minister of Taliban government says in a lot of press in Europe and in the Times, the newspaper, the British newspaper, that the Taliban power would like to negotiate with U.S. And, of course, it was just a sort of a declaration to do some official discussion.
I'm going to ask you to hold for 1 sec as we break for stations to identify themselves. But then don't worry, when we come back, we're going to go right to you. Unlike what happened at CNN, it was one of the funnier interviews I'd ever seen, except that the information would have been so important to get out. We'll talk about that in just a minute as well. When you were invited on yesterday, I believe it was the shortest soundbite I'd ever heard. You got to say hello before they told you goodbye. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. We're talking to the two co-authors of an explosive book that is out in French but just published in English. It's called Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. Our guests are in Paris, France. Stay with us.
Look here at this watch of mine. Gotta open it up. Don't know who's been in it. Tracking where I go, finding out all my business. Secure, rough, tick. Video cameras locked on me. In every dressing room, on every floor, in every store. Damn, can I get that democracy and equality and privacy? That you're blind, baby, you neglect to see the drugs coming into my community, weapons coming into my community, dirty cops in my community, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free.
Jill Scott watching me here on the War and Peace Report Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion with Jean-Charles Broussard and Guillaume Dasqui, authors of Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. Jean-Charles Broussard worked for French Secret Services, wrote a report for them in 1997 on Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network, met with the deputy director of FBI, John O'Neill, before he died in the World Trade Center on September 11th, and discussed, among other issues, why he quit the FBI out of frustration for the Bush administration's blocking of investigations into the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda network. He felt simply to block the investigations for the oil industry that had its sights set on Afghanistan. We also are talking to Guillaume Dasqui, investigative journalist, publisher of Intelligence Online. I first saw you both, so I have to credit CNN, yesterday on Paula Zahn's program. But as Guillaume Dasqui, after he said hello, he never said another word because they cut off the interview. I assume, Mr. Dasqui, you were a bit surprised to have been brought into a studio only to be told goodbye.
What is important today is not to to understand the role of CNN, but more important is to understand that, you know, after the, for example, just after the 9/11 terror attacks, there were very strong critics in U.S. and also in Europe on the ability of the FBI to neutralize Al-Qaeda. And we think it's a very unfair judgment against the FBI, even if the FBI has a few problems, but every intelligence or law enforcement services in Europe or in U.S. has some problems. But the FBI, I think, is composed of a very loyal and efficient agent and very effective informants. And if U.S. had let the FBI work, if U.S. administration had let them go as far as they intended to go, I'm sure that Al-Qaeda maybe would not have been neutralized, but at least would not have been as well as it was before 9/11, not so strong. And it's obvious that that U.S. and many developed countries underestimated the organization. And it's the result of an error in the analysis of the situation. We always consider Saudi Arabia as a partner that we absolutely and systematically had to protect because for oil interest. But this is the Saudi Arabia clergy and the Saudi Arabia Muslim leader who always wanted to help and to support and support Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. That's the most interesting reality. And maybe today it's important to discuss in all developed countries on that point and not to try to understand why FBI can or could not or could track Al-Qaeda.
Mr. Dusky, what evidence do you have that the Saudi Arabian regime supported Al-Qaeda?
You know, every people who work on terrorist organization know for a long, long time that the focal point of the financial network for international Muslim terrorism come from Saudi Arabia and come from Jeddah, because the Saudi Arabia kingdom is built like that. You know, in Saudi Arabia, there is the political power. The political power is in the end of the Al Saud family. Okay, and everybody know King Fahd Al Saud, who is the king of the Saudi Arabia. But on the other hand, you have the Al-Sher family in Saudi Arabia. And Al-Sher family, this is the family who had the spiritual power, the religious power. And this is a very old view of the Muslim and with some terror consideration, like a dictatorship. And for them, they always consider that U.S. is an enemy, and they always consider that supporting Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was a good thing.
Go ahead.
But because, you know, the power in Saudi Arabia depends on the pact, the deal between Al-Sher family and Al-Saud family, and because we have a lot of deal on oil issue, we never wanted to speak on that very sensitive items with Al-Saud family, and we always do like these things never exist. And so we wanted to stay blind, and maybe the 9/11 is the consequences of that fact.
We're talking to Guillaume Dasqui and Jean-Charles Brissard, both in Paris, France, co-authors of the book that has just been translated into English, Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. It has just come out in the last few weeks that the United States' new special envoy to Kabul once lobbied for the Taliban. I'm actually looking at a piece in a British newspaper today explaining just who he is. The U.S. new special envoy to Kabul once lobbied for the Taliban and worked for an American oil company that sought concessions for pipelines in Afghanistan. Zalmay Khalilzad, who was born in Afghanistan, has arrived in Kabul amid much publicity as the representative of the country that put the new government in power. He's a highly influential position. In one of his first press conferences, Mr. Khalilzad condemned the Taliban as sponsors of terrorism and vowed the U.S. would continue the military campaign until they and their allies in Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network are eradicated. But in 1997, as a paid advisor to the U.S. multinational oil corporation Unocal, he took part in talks with Taliban officials regarding the possibility of building highly lucrative gas and oil pipelines. He had drawn up a risk analysis report for the project that would have exploited the natural reserves of the region, estimated to be the world's second largest after the Persian Gulf. At the same time, he urged the Clinton administration to take a softer line on the Taliban. By 1997, some of the regime's worst excesses had become public, and bin Laden was ensconced in Afghanistan. That year, Albright described the Taliban abuse of human rights as despicable. But Mr. Khalilzad defended them in the Washington Post. He wrote, "The Taliban do not practice the anti-U.S. style of fundamentalism practiced by Iran. We should be willing to offer recognition and humanitarian assistance and to promote international economic reconstruction. It is time for the United States to re-engage. Without such re-engagement, it would not have been possible for Unocal to pursue its goal to build a gas pipeline from the landlocked former Soviet Republic of Turkmenistan through Afghanistan into Pakistan with a possible extension into India." And it goes on from there, talking about how Unocal had been involved in a commercial war for the pipeline concession with an Argentinian company, Brightus, and goes on from there. I wanted to get, Mr. Brissard, your response to this piece that has just come out in the British newspaper, The Independent.
Well, what I will say is you must remember that the important for the U.S. government, its main objective for years now in Afghanistan was to stabilize the position of the Taliban regime, to gain access, in fact, to oil and gas reserves in Central Asia. And in fact, until August of that of 2001, the U.S. government saw the Taliban regime as a source of stability in that region that would probably enable the construction of a pipeline, a project which was designed by a U.S. firm, Unocal, with sponsors from Saudi Arabia, and to carry oil from rich oil fields in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan to Pakistan via Afghanistan. So negotiations with them started long ago under Clinton administration. The negotiations were first dedicated at the release of Osama bin Laden, which was a legitimate purpose, I may say. But by the time the economic pressure went growing during those negotiations, and we have the situation in the mid-2001 where the deal proposed to the Taliban at those negotiations conducted in various areas, in Berlin especially, is or they accept the deal of the United States, oil subsidies and international recognition, or they the U.S. Representative to those negotiations made it clear that it would come to a military option for the U.S. if the Taliban refuses. But during all that period, the Taliban were viewed as very accommodating. They were received in Houston, Texas. They had a representative, as you told before. The U.S. and Western countries only, you know, discovered the real nature of the regime after September 11th. But in practice, they were all aware of what the Taliban were.
Explain this meeting in Texas with the Taliban.
Well, the Unocal firm invited in 1997 a representative from the Taliban to Houston, Texas, to meet with several representatives of the oil companies, oil interests in the United States. Back in Afghanistan, the Taliban executives received many presents from many gifts from those companies, and the relationship was clear and friendly between the both parties in that deal.
I'm looking at the testimony of the Vice President of International Relations of UNICAL in 1998 before Congress, the Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. He says, from the outset, we've made clear that construction of the pipeline we've proposed across Afghanistan could not begin until a recognized government is in place that has the confidence of government's lenders and our company. Mr. Broussard, you talk about meeting with the Taliban, negotiations that U.S. representatives had with the Taliban, where they told them, either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold or we bury you under a carpet of bombs. Can you explain what that meeting, those negotiations were about? Mr. Broussard?
Yes.
Can you explain what those negotiations were about?
Well, maybe Guillaume Dusky will do that.
Guillaume Dusky.
Yeah. Testimony about that meeting.
You know, what is very important to understand is that until 1997, as everybody agreed to set up the Taliban, the U.S. were the first who favored the Saudi Secret Service in their financing of the Taliban, and by using certain units of the Pakistani Secret Service. And just after September 1997, after there was a very important incident, the European Commissioner came officially to Afghanistan and was arrested because basically she did not fit with the dressing code of the Taliban. So after this date, officially, the Taliban became a sort of rogue state, and officially, everybody stopped negotiate with the Taliban. And that's the reason why there's a sort a declaration like the one you speak from the UNOCAL public relation. But after this date, after the September 1997, everybody wanted to continue the negotiation because the for every developed country, the Taliban had realized something very important. They stabilized Afghanistan, and stabilization of the Afghanistan is the key to control the Central Asia and the oil reserve of Central Asia. So after this date, the negotiation continued, but it became secret with many, many organizations. And there is a secret group, which is name is 6+2 group, which has set up by U.S. and by all the country inside the United Nations Security Council. And, this group organized some meeting. The first one is in Tashkent, in Uzbekistan, in July 1999. And at every time that this negotiation tried to propose something for the Taliban to manage something in their government and to say them, just try to be more politically correct for the international country and international organization, and after we can do some deal with you. But what is very dramatically and horrible is that, Taliban never wanted to become a political correct nation, and all the negotiation, all the secret negotiation during all these years, try to do some political correct items for the Taliban. And all the time, Taliban refused to do that. And that's the reason why, at the end, in the last meeting in Berlin, in last July, in July 2001, you know, U.S. envoy and former U.S. ambassador say that said to a Pakistani counterpart that for the Taliban, we can give some gold with the International Monetary Fund, or we can do the war. And it was in last July. And this is a very, very important July act.
We're talking to Guillaume Dusky. Finally, Jean-Charles Brissard, a co-author of Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. I wanted to get to the significance of Christina Rocha, who is at the State Department now, met the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zaif, in August of 2001. This is a part of the meeting that Mr. Dusky is talking about. And her whole history, having been formerly with the CIA.
Yes, well, I'm sorry, but I think Guillaume will go through that better than me, because that's his part.
Okay, Guillaume, go ahead.
Yes, we kept an eye for a very long time on Christina Rocha, and this is a, you know, in France, in UCA, or and in US, of course, there is some personalities, some people very important, like because during all the 80s. They were on the good part, you know. She just negotiated inside the CIA. She was a CIA officer, and inside the CIA, she negotiated with all the Islamic group in Afghanistan. But in the 80s,
and sold them Stinger missiles.
Yeah. And during the 80s, negotiate and to have good contact with Islamic group in Afghanistan, it was a very good thing, because it was during the war against Soviet in Afghanistan. So during this war, our job was to provide some help and some support for the Islamic group who fight against Soviet army. And now, you know, she had the same contact, but those people at those times became the Taliban. And, you know, a lot of Taliban leaders was some war leaders and Islamic leaders, Mujahideen leaders, during the war against Soviet, Soviet army. And so this is exactly the same contact, just continue year after year. But right now, in last year, in you know, in August, when she contact and when she met the some Taliban foreign ministry political leaders in Islamabad, it was not to discuss about Osama bin Laden capture, but it was to, every time, the same thing, to discuss how the Afghanistan could become a very political correct country, because it, every time for developed country, it was a very important item to deal something to cross with pipeline Afghanistan and to take over Central Asia.
Guillaume Dusky and Jean-Charles Brissard. They are co-authors of the book, The Forbidden Truth. It has not been published in the United States. Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. As we turn now to our music break today, booksnotbombs.org.
The bourgeoisie has seen its last day, and our class comes for back pay. And it's the big payback, leaving the capitalists and the running dogs flat on their back with their knees up, praying that the power of the people will ease up. The power of the proletariat don't stop in it.
won't stop and it don't stop and it won't stop today.
You can feel the earth shift to the left today. The enemy draws his last breath today. The final conflict, no sequel today. The whole world belongs to the people today.
You can feel the earth shift to the left
today.
The enemy draws his last breath
today.
The final conflict, no sequel
today.
The whole world belongs to the people, y'all.
Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The Angolan government has displayed the dead body of CIA-sponsored rebel leader Jonas Savimbi. Government officials say he was killed in a commando raid in the far eastern region of the country on Friday. Savimbi was head of the Washington-backed UNITA movement. He was touted as a key ally against communism by the U.S. and was received as a head of state by President Reagan at the White House in 1986. In addition to the millions of dollars he received from Washington in covert aid, Savimbi and UNITA also had substantial backing from the white apartheid government in South Africa, as well as the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko of the former Zaire. Over the weekend, people throughout the Angolan capital celebrated his death. Film of Savimbi's bloodied body was shown on state TV. The body was surrounded by soldiers and swarms of flies. He was still clad in his olive fatigues and had an apparent bullet hole in his neck. We're joined right now in our Firehouse studio by Alambe Brath. He's chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition in New York and a producer at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. His program is called Afro Kaleidoscope. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Well, can you talk about the significance of Jonas Savimbi's death?
I think that it's very important that this has happened. And it's been something that the Angolan government has been really trying to do for quite some time. And the reason is that even though he had caused so much, you know, death and mayhem, the fact is that they were trying to work something out because the United States had put forth this notion that even the most extremist of terrorist leaders could be or should be included into governments. They did it in Mozambique, and they are trying to do it in every other place, that the people who they see as beneficial to their interests that have fought for them, when it comes to the time that they try to negotiate, the idea is to make sure that these people are included, and they wanted to make sure that Savimbi was included. The fact is that Savimbi had always argued that he was the main, most popular figure, all this stuff about his charisma, and he sort of really believed it, and that he would automatically win the election because he belongs to the Abobondo, which is 40% of the population. But because Savimbi has so devastated Angola and so many people have been hurt by him, you know, Angola vies for, Afghanistan, which country has the most amputees, you know, due to war. And so the people did not really forget that in 1992. So for one of the things most leading about Savimbi is that he was always this charismatic guerrilla fighter. But in reality, when Savimbi first came on the scene, you know, after he came back from Lausanne to Switzerland and getting his PhD in political science, he had tried first to join the MPLA, but at a hierarchical level. They didn't want to go along with that. So then he joined the FNLA, which is another group led by Holden Roberto, which is also on a CIA retainer from the Kennedy administration. He had come here to this country. We met him, you know, and talked to him, and he was supposed to be leading the struggle. But then later on it was discovered that he had been contacted by the Kennedy administration, and they put him on a retainer, that in the event that something would happen to the Portuguese government, that he would be called out and be able to do their work. And so when Savimbi joined this organization in 1964, at an OAU meeting, conference,
the Organization of African Unity.
Organization of African Unity. It was Savimbi that jumped up and said, "This man is an American agent. He serves American interests," and he resigned. But since he could not get any role in the MPLA, he formed his own organization 2 years later in Mexico, the same place where he was always killed, the same place where he was born. So the fact is that he formed the Total National Total Unity for the Liberation of Angola. And
and this was against the Portuguese at the time.
Yeah, against the Portuguese. But while the Portuguese were supposed to be, trying to ferret out these national liberation movement people, both the MPLA, the FNLA, and UNITA, when they finally, the Portuguese fascist government, which is a real true, bona fide, board certified fascist government, when it fell in April of 1974 and the socialist government came in, they went through the archives and found an explosive series of letters that all the time that Savimbi was fighting, he had been in contact with the Portuguese secret police. There was correspondence, extensive correspondence with letters that showed that he was fighting more against the MPLA, trying to coordinate both activities of the Portuguese along with his own and trying to make sure that the Portuguese did not mistake his group for the MPLA. So he was really totally discredited. So that when the government, when the Avoro Accords, which was supposed to negotiate how Angola was going to be independent on the 11th of November, 1975, before that happened, there was a struggle in Angola between the FNLA and the MPLA. The Angolan, the MPLA was able to force the FNLA out of the country because they realized, and Angola being a Marxist organization, they knew these people were agents of capitalism, so they forced them out. And then Savimbi went and joined back in an alliance so that when the independence of Angola was announced on November 11, 1975 in Luanda, there was a counter independence announcement in Huambo, in the southern part of Angola, which was attended by the Contras from Nicaragua, I think some African Mujahideen, as well as some all types of reactions from around the world. Roy Innes of CORE attended also. And it was a real, trying to put that it was two governments. And eventually what happened is that the South African regime, along with Savimbi, attacked the capital of Luanda from the south, coming from South Africa, going into Angola, whereas from above, from Congo or Zaire at the time, Mobutu's army with his brother-in-law, Holden Roberto, who was the head of FNLA, came down from the north. So there was a pincer movement moving on the capital. Agostinho Neto, the president of Angola, sent out an international call for assistance from other people around the world. Guinea-Conakry under Secretary gave help. Congo-Brazzaville under Mari Dungwabi gave help. Nigeria under Murtala Mohamed also gave help. But the most critical help that came was the Cuban volunteers that Fidel Castro sent from Havana to Luanda. And it was at that particular time that the whole course of what was going to go for the next couple of years was established. That for 15 years, the Cubans would fight, in the defense of Angola, and it had not been for the intervention of the Cubans in Angola, which actually helped to spur the same type of resistance in the other countries that were fighting for their liberation in the Southern Africa. The independent countries of Southern Africa, they might never have actually attained their goals.
We're talking to Alambe Brath, chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition in New York, about the death of Jonas Savimbi, killed by Angolan government forces this weekend. His riddled body shown on national television throughout Angola. Can you talk about the U.S. relationship with Savimbi going back to Reagan?
Well,
and also the South African relationship.
Well, what happened is that when the independence took place, you have to remember that the Ford administration was in there now, and major person or the Secretary of Defense was Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's war. That's the reason why when Rumsfeld got this job, now we say that while other people were talking about other things, they had contradictions. I said this is the man that caused all of this havoc because he set the pattern. The New York Times did a big a front page story to let everybody know that what the sides were, that the UNITA and FNLA were being promoted as black nationalist organizations, which it really was surrogates of the CIA, and also in Savimbi's case, some people who worked along with PEED, which was the secret police of Portugal, and as well as the South African government. And then you had Holden Roberto, who had been discredited already. But the idea was to get the black community in the United States to think that it was a question about black nationalism versus communism. And people are supposed to line up like that, but a lot of us, that's when we formed the Patrice Lumumba Coalition on the same day as the government of Angola was formed to make sure that it was clear in the United States, even the black politicians didn't understand it, that it had to be grassroots organization and mobilization on behalf of the MPLA. And that was one of the things that set another dynamic within the black community to try to stop the schism between so-called revolutionary nationalists and Marxist-Leninists. But most of the people who were Marxists, who were Maoists, they thought it would be better for them to go along with Savimbi, because he was also at the same time being promoted as somebody who had training in China, and he was spouting, you know, phrases from the Red Book, and he was supposed to be a Maoist. And they said that because of his tactics, he was using the same kind of guerrilla tactics that Mao Zedong used in his movement to power.
What about South Africa apartheid regime?
South Africa apartheid regime counted on Savimbi. Savimbi could be able to go in and out. And one of the things that's kind of disturbing is that in the Daily Challenge today, which is the only black daily in the New York City, or there's two black dailies now, the Daily Journal, but the front page story, Few Africans Mourn Savimbi, there's an interesting picture inside which shows you that picture of Savimbi with Nelson Mandela, you know, in 1995, because some people thought they could still work with Savimbi. It was a very disturbing picture because, you know, it was recent. It was after he had actually put himself out for the elections in 1992 and then lost the election and then went back to war. So what is happening during this time is over 1 million people have been killed, and nobody knows how many people have actually lost limbs, you know, and all called the social devastation to the country is something we have to deal with, too. Angola is one of the richest countries in the world with oil and diamonds. And now the diamonds, the so-called conflict diamonds, blood diamonds, have been mostly focused on...
We only have 30 seconds.
On Angola and Sierra Leone. But with Jonas Savimbi out of the way, I think that is an opportunity now for peace to come to Angola, and hopefully that will be the case.
Well, Alambe Brath, I want to thank you for being with us, Chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles smell like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where trouble melts like lemon drops high above the chimney top. That's where you find me, oh, somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Oh, why can't I?
to myself, what a wonderful world. Well, I see skies of blue and I see clouds of white and the brightness of day. I like the dark.